Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, who's a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's leading the Union of Concerned Scientists climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the deserts in the Southwest. Dr. Eckwurzel completed her doctorate work at Lamont Doherty Earth Observation of Columbia University and her postdoctoral research at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel.
Thank you so much.
And I take it that the findings from the Scripps Oceanographic Institute's installation on top of the Hawaiian volcano Mauna Loa, which began back in 1958, when the CO2 level was at 315 parts per million, the fact that the global CO2 level reached 400 parts per million this week, the highest in 3.6 million years. How significant is this?
It's very, very significant, in part because the research for very precise measurements happening at the top of this very pristine part of the world, in that it's Hawaii, is in the very surrounded by the vast Pacific Ocean. So when there's snatches of air samples that are taken up there, very careful, precise measurements, as you said, since the late 1950s. And to jump from 350 parts per million up to 400 parts per million is something that really is a fingerprint that human activities are altering and overloading carbon in our atmosphere, which is leading to warming up of the planet. To put that in perspective, we also have very good measurements, as you said, millions of years, and the most precise measurements over the long time are the first 800,000 years, where we saw that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere bounced around between around 180 parts per million and 280 parts per million. So back in 1958, it was already above this historic level, where we would swing through ice ages, cold periods, and warm periods. And so we have higher carbon dioxide in our atmosphere than we've had for 800,000, several million years. And the last time we had very high carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, we had very warm conditions 55 million years ago. And we know from past climate that the Earth is quite sensitive to this heat-trapping gas. So it's rising very rapidly. Only a few decades have we reached this threshold, and 400 parts per million is actually an indicator of very dangerous conditions coming ahead.
Well, one of the things that I understand happens with global warming is that it's a sort of self-reinforcing mechanism. As global warming gets worse and as more of the Arctic ice melts, less sunlight is reflected back into outer space and more of it absorbed by the dark ocean. As the permafrost melts, it releases methane, which exponentially increases. It's one of the worst of the global warming gases. The real question is, when do we sort of stop? Well, we have several problems. We have global warming denial. We have fudging the goalposts and the inability of countries in international forums to come up with a regime. My understanding is that China now creates most of the CO2 or the bulk of it, but the U.S. has created most of what's already up there. And the big powers seem to be talking past each other. What's your sense of this being a wake-up call?
I think 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, it doesn't care whether a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, a Lithuanian, an American, someone who lives in China, India, it doesn't care where the carbon dioxide or the methane comes from, which later it swirls around the atmosphere for a decade and traps a lot more heat than CO2, but then it turns into CO2. So methane becomes carbon dioxide. So ultimately carbon dioxide doesn't care who puts it up there. It should not matter the politics on the ground. we are all on this planet together, and we all share a burden of responsibility, but some activities are worse than other activities. And the good news is that if we are fed up and frustrated with the lack of action by nations or international agreements, there is something that we can do as individuals to help slow the pace of further climate change. And if every American were to reduce our personal emissions 20%, that would be the equivalent of not needing the electricity from a third of our traditional size coal-fired power plants. So that'd be like turning off 200 of the 600 traditional coal-fired power plants.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who's a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists, as she is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. And we're talking about the 400 parts per million threshold level being reached and recorded in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in on the Hawaiian volcano of Mauna Loa, where the highest levels in 3.6 million years have been recorded of CO2. And here in Los Angeles, of course, Brenda, there's a coal-fired plant out in the Mojave Desert that supplies an awful lot of the electricity for Los Angeles. They have decided to phase it out, but even that's going to take about a decade. So again, you get the feeling that people are starting to recognize that this is real, and that Hurricane Sandy and the destruction and the fires and the floods, the weather people on television tend to be somewhat hysterical in it. They don't give you context. There's a difference between weather and climate, which perhaps you should explain to us.
Sure. The difference between weather and climate change really is the average state of affairs, so that in the semi-arid conditions of the southwestern part of the United States, you say you live in a semi-arid climate, or if you have the temperate conditions of a higher latitude states in the United States, you say you have a temperate climate. And so the difference is that in that temperate climate or the southwest U.S., there's certain weather patterns that happen, and the weather is something that lasts maybe 4 to 5 days. And you can have big temperature swings. And some say that climate change, that average shifting global average temperature of a degree or so, doesn't sound like much when the weather can have many, many degrees of change even just in one day. But the difference is, just as a bell curve that we remember from school and the grading curve, if you shift that average, the difference is that the tail end of the curve means that intense heat wave events that are before were very, very rare are now much more likely, and we can experience heat waves that can really put lives at risk, especially elderly or the very young. Those type of events are now possible that wouldn't have been possible before. So we have more extreme events, which are definitely linked to the warming planet. And the three that have the biggest scientific evidence are extreme heat waves, coastal flooding, and intense precipitation.
But my understanding, Brenda Eckwessel, is that obviously the rise of CO2 continues. China, of course, is pumping a lot of CO2 from its coal-fired plants. I mentioned that they're going to close the one that serves Los Angeles, but they're going to take their time doing it. Meanwhile, CO2 goes up there all the time. It's reached 400 parts per million. But if the pace of this last decade continues, carbon dioxide, according to the Scripps people who run those instruments on Mauna Loa, say that carbon dioxide will reach 450 parts per million by the year 2040. So it's continuing. We keep talking about it. It keeps going up into the atmosphere, but very little is being done.
That you bring up a very, very good point. The reason scientists are so concerned about the pace of reaching 400 parts per million, since 1958 we were 315 parts per million. That is, approaching 100 parts per million increase in carbon dioxide. Now think about going between ice ages and warm periods of the 800,000 years. That was bouncing around between 180 and 280 parts per million. That's a 100 part per million shift. In just you know, a few decades, we've increased the atmospheric concentration, you know, approaching another 100 parts per million. Between 280 to 400, we're over 100 parts per million more CO2. In the past, when climate folks talk about past climates, we've seen higher CO2 levels. But let me tell you something about it. It did not happen as fast as this. This is a new regime. We've never seen such a fast increase in carbon dioxide. So in the past, when we had big rises in CO2, the ocean could keep pace. It would take several million years. And we saw the ocean life survive pretty well. Then we had another rapid rise of CO2 that happened over hundreds of thousands of years. And we saw more extinctions on the planet. But the oceans were able to keep pace. Right now, we're going so fast that we're acidifying the oceans, and there are little organisms that make shells and so on. We're seeing in cold Arctic environments, coral reefs, other behavior. We're basically eroding the base of the ocean food chain. Meanwhile, we are overfishing at the top of the food chain, and so the oceans are under crisis because of the pace of change. If we were to slow it down, it gives more time for us to adapt, as well as ecosystems. But the pace of change is what has us so alarmed.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Brenda Quessel, when do you think there'll be palpable and irrefutable evidence so that people like the Koch brothers and others and the big oil companies that fund the denial, which still has some traction, particularly in the U.S. Senate, you know, when, in other words, when you see the ocean level, literally beaches disappear, lowlands flooding, etc., when do you think that will become manifest?
What we see is that, for example, with storm surge that comes in, for example, Hurricane Sandy, it's overtopping the battery of lower Manhattan. If that exact same natural conditions happen with that storm and we're approaching lower Manhattan and parts of New Jersey over a century ago, then that would have been 8 inches on average less global average sea level rise. That amount of sea level rise is due in large part to expansion of the oceans through temperature increases from global warming, as well as accelerated melting of the ice sheets that are on land. And so we have defenses that we've built up over the last century to protect our coastal communities. And the San Francisco Bay Area region, you know, the defenses were built for a pace of sea level rise that is now accelerating, that does not take that into account. And so communities have to be more resilient and make better plans and plan for even more accelerated sea level rise in the future, because right now we haven't even have the infrastructure to protect people from the climate change that's already occurred.
Well, Dr. Brenda Quessel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Brenda Quessel, who's a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool that she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert Southwest. Dr. Quessel completed her doctorate work at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University and postdoctorate research at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Dr. Amitai Etzioni about why the liberal narrative is broken and that only populism can fix it.